And I was asked to talk about multiculturalism in Canada, so I thought a good idea. Well, I wasn't really going to talk about multiculturalism, but the question was, how do we start talking about Canada in a classroom? And I thought that maybe multiculturalism would be a very good way of actually starting to discover Canada, because I know that we all have definitions of multiculturalism, but multiculturalism in Canada is slightly different. It's a public policy, which is slightly different from what we know here in France. And I thought the best way of starting talking about Canada is to talk about its flag first. I'm not a specialist, really, in Canadian history, even though, because I specialize mostly in English-Canadian literature, but I do teach a Canadian heritage class, and I know that when I prepare the classes and ask them what they know about Canada, you can very easily guess what kind of answers I get. Maple syrup, people living in cabins in very cold weather. So that is the stereotype that sticks still today to Canada. And to talk about the history, I'm not going to flood you with historical information. That was not my point. But I think it's important to go over that, to revisit the major historical turning points that led all the way up to multiculturalism as a public policy in Canada. So I wanted to start with this very recognizable symbol, the maple leaf that you have here up top, right there. But you may not know how old it is. So it's a very recent flag, in fact. It's not even 60 years old. It was chosen in 1965. And before that flag, they used to use what you have here called the Canadian Red Ensign. It's the ensign. It's the kind of flag that you would find on boats. You know that boats, when they sail, got these little flags that are at the back so that you can recognize the boat and the nationality of the boat. But I think this transition, this change, is a very good representation of the evolution from biculturalism to multiculturalism. Because if you look at the ensign, what do you see first? You see the Union Jack, which means that Canada is British, which is true politically. But I'll say more about that in a few minutes. And then we have, if you look at that little figure right here, this is the Canadian coat of arms, coat of arms, where you have different symbols. You've got in the top left-hand corner, you've got the English lions, and then you've got the Scottish lion. Then you can see the Irish harp, the French fleur-de-lis, and right below that, you've got the maple leaves. So the idea, this red ensign, what does it mean? It means that Canada is divided into two nations, a French-speaking nation and an English-speaking nation. But that would change. I'm going to talk about the changes today. And so as the Canadian flag goes back to 1965, they wanted to choose a symbol that could represent, that everybody could actually identify with. That was very important, instead of just British and French culture. But I'm going to be talking about the people from Quebec as well. Good. So again, I wanted to revisit the major turning points in Canadian history without, again, flooding you with too much information. I'd like to start with the Indigenous peoples of Canada. That is a very important aspect of Canadian culture today, with a lot of impacts and effects on Canadian culture even today. And then talk about the Francophones as well, the Francophones of Quebec. So to talk about Indigenous peoples and the Francophone community of Canada. Well, when the Europeans arrived, that was in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, well, there were about 200,000 and 500,000 Indigenous people on the spot, on site, when the Europeans arrived. Some say it's more than that. Some say it was about 2 million, even 3 million, but today, what they're saying is that there were about 500,000 people living there already, and the contact was not always very friendly at first, to say the least. But today, what do the Indigenous people today in Canada represent? They represent about 5% of the population today of Canada. There are over 630 First Nation or Indigenous communities in Canada, and they speak over 70 languages. So that's a very wide variety of Indigenous cultures and languages in Canada today. And it's also important to pay attention to words as well, because a lot of Canadians are very careful with the words they use. Today, we usually use the word Indigenous to refer to all of these people, but the Indigenous peoples of Canada are divided into three categories or subcategories. We have the First Nations, that's one category, the most important one, subcategory of Indigenous peoples. Then we have the Métis. Usually they come from, they were called a long time ago, they were called half-breeds. Métis. So they were usually considered to be a mix of French explorers and Indigenous women. And the last subgroup is the Inuit, who live, for the most of them, they live in Arctic Canada. Good. And I also wanted to talk, before talking about the dominant British culture, I wanted to talk about those that consider, that see themselves still today as dominated communities. So we have the Francophone community. And it was King Henry IV of France, a very famous king that that is talked about, mentioned in all school books, I believe, today at school. And it was King Henry IV who sent this fellow right here, represented on the statue in the top left-hand corner, who is Samuel de Champlain. So this room could have been called Samuel de Champlain, who came after Jacques Cartier. But anyway, Quebec was founded in 1608, and this is the moment that is almost religiously defended by a lot of Quebecers. This is the founding moment, and this moment, this foundation of Quebec, is the moment when, or the moment that defines or justifies French Canada. So Canada is also French. This is really on the side, but in 2008 there was a huge concert outside of Montreal in Quebec with Céline Dion, Daou, celebrating the 400 years of Quebec. So it's a really, really big thing. And so, well, that led to conflict as well. So the French explorers were had a lot of very rich trade relations with the Indigenous, and that made the British jealous sometimes. So that led to conflict, and whenever the English and the French fought a war, usually the winner was always the British. So in 1763 was that date when actually the French lost, and Canada became a British colony. And so, when Canada became a British colony, it became, it was the new British crown that actually gained full control over not only the Indigenous populations of Canada, but also the Francophone communities, the Francophone part of Canada. And as time went on, I'll just, again, I won't flood you with too much information, but in 1867, this is the birth of what is close to what modern Canada is. And so in 1867, we only had, in Canada, there were only like separate colonies, and so four colonies decided to come together and say, okay, let's form a government. Okay, let's form one government. And so that started out with four, and from 1867 onwards, that four would grow into 10, and then three territories. So now today you've got a map here in the bottom left-hand corner where you have the political map of Canada with 10 provinces and three territories up in the north. And that's also very important to remember, even for students in second year or even high school students, whenever you talk about school, because in fact education is not decided on a federal level, okay? So that means that when there was Confederation, there was the creation of a federal government, just like the United States, and then each province, they're called provinces in Canada, each province would have its own local provincial government. And so education today is managed by the local and provincial governments, meaning that if you take your school kids, I don't know, one day to one province, the system will be totally different in Quebec than what it could be in Ontario, for example. So that's very, very different. And so, in 1867, there was the Confederation of Canada, and that meant that the federal government could actually slowly, slowly start organizing the territory, like a Western expansion. I'm sure you're all familiar with the American myth of the frontier. Well, the Canadians have done the same thing, except you had less cowboys and things like that. But they started organizing not only the territory, but also the people. And who was living there? The indigenous people of Canada. Peoples, because they're different communities, ethnic groups. And so they started, and one of the first acts taken by the government in order to manage these people was the Indian Act. And a lot of indigenous people today still don't like this word, and for very good reasons, is that the Indian Act led to the creation of residential schools. And this echoes what you were saying about the Stolen Generation. Residential schools in Canada, it does sound nice, but it's not nice at all. They translate it in French, internat. And so actually, in order to assimilate all of these First Nations and indigenous communities, they would take the children away from the families and forbid them from speaking their native languages. And so they would be displaced in order to turn them into perfect Europeanized Canadians. That was the policy at the time. And the Canadian government today actually apologized, but the apology came a little late. It was in 2008. And I believe that the statement about apology is something that I included in your booklet as well that you can find, where the Prime Minister says, "I'm sorry," in five languages, three indigenous languages, French and English. Okay, so it came a little late. And I believe the last residential school, but I would have to check that, was closed in the 1980s or 90s. Good. But over, so I'm going to skip ahead, of course, so over the 20th century, two world wars. Canada would change a lot after World War II, mainly thanks to immigration. So here, I'm not going to go into the details of this chart, but it's just to show that there's a drop in immigration during the war, and then it soars, really, after that. So we have a lot of immigration coming in from various countries, because it used to be restricted. Immigration to Canada before World War II was aimed to greet Western Europeans, especially white. But with World War II, the end of World War II, what happened, in fact, is that there was a huge economic boom in Canada at the time, and they needed a lot of workers. And so they encouraged a lot of people from all over the world to come to Canada and immigrate. And so that changed the entire sociology of Canada. And that was also a problem for some Quebecers, not all of them, because in the 1960s, there was this period of economic development, of wealth, of modernization, called the Quiet Revolution. And you really have to be a Canadian to invent a word like that, don't you think? Like, how can a revolution be quiet? But here it's represented as a very prosperous period of Canadian history, and so encouraging again a lot of immigrants from all over the world to come and populate Canada and strengthen the workforce. Good, but a lot of Quebecers, working class Quebecers, a lot of Quebecers were not really on board with this because they were feeling, some of them felt that their Francophone culture was fading under the pressure of not only immigration, but also the rest of Anglophone Canada. Okay, one idea we get, it's true that when we say Canada to a French person, they think Quebec, always. But Quebec is a French-speaking province, not just, because Montreal is bilingual as well, but it's a French-speaking province, but it's the only province in which the French speakers are a majority. What you have to remember, I think, as well, is that you've got Francophone communities all over Canada, even in Newfoundland, which is the least populated. I know that place personally. And you've got a very small 2,000, about 2,000 people who are French in a province that counts about 600,000 people, which is, it's a big surface. You really got to appreciate the size. The dimensions are very, very different. When you look at a map, you think that, oh, it's very easy to go from there to there. But no, it takes you a whole day to get there. Anyway, and so a lot of Francophones, as I was saying, were afraid that their culture was disappearing. And so the Canadian government felt that and decided to maybe propose a few solutions to guarantee that French identity and the French language would not disappear, and that took the form of biculturalism. And so that led to a commission, the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism. That was a commission of a lot of experts trying to gather to see what kind of solutions we could propose to the French speakers of Canada in order to guarantee the distinctiveness of their culture. And as a result of this, this resulted in the Official Languages Act of 1969, where English and French become the two official languages of Canada. Official. I believe that the Americans don't have written anywhere, they don't have an official language, even though everybody understands it's English. But there is, it's written nowhere that there's an official language in the United States, but it's the case in Canada. Two official languages, and I'm going to show you a law right after this, just some kind of snapshot, to show you that a law has to be written in both English and French. And a lot of people complain, because you may not really be able to represent the consequences of the Official Languages Act. It meant that if you are a citizen, and you go to an administration, for example, préfecture, or that kind of thing, you would have, the government employee would have to speak to answer your questions in either French or English. Meaning, but the problem was that a lot of government employees did not know how to speak French. So they all had to be sent back to school. That's what happened. And it cost a lot of money, and a lot of people complained about that then. This little law, this little act of parliament would have huge consequences. Sending all the government employees back to school. And new teachers, and so on. Good. And it was also the rise of, as I was explaining, the rise of nationalism as well in Quebec, because they felt that all around them, everybody was speaking English, but here in Quebec, they wanted to speak French. And they all say a few words about the Charter of the French Language, La Charte de la Langue Française, that was written in and voted in 1977. Anyway, there was a huge rise of nationalism at the time, and this may be on the side, but there was one very, I would say, sensitive moment when the French president came to visit the Canadians in 1967. I don't know if anybody has heard about that. His name was Le Général de Gaulle. Anyway, what happened is that in 1967, I told you that the Confederation was created in 1867, so in 1967, the Canadians were celebrating their 100th birthday. And so they wanted to organize the World Fair of 1967. And what did the Général de Gaulle want to do? I'm going to go to Quebec, and I'm going to encourage all of these French Canadians, these Quebecers, to go on with their revolution to modernize and develop new ties with France. Well, his speech did not go very well. Because he concluded his speech with that very famous vive le Québec, libre. And so that suggested that actually Quebec was not free, but dominated and exploited by the Anglophone, dominant Anglophone culture in Canada. Good, and it was the Prime Minister, I didn't give his name, big surprise, his name was Pierre Elliott Trudeau. So Justin's father, and he was a lot more famous at the time than Justin is today. And so it was his father, Pierre-Éliott Trudeau, in 1971, he decided to give a speech on multiculturalism. As I was saying, actually the population, the sociology of the population was rapidly changing, and biculturalism was not enough. You can't limit Canada or Canadian identity to just two cultures. So we have to open everything up to other cultures as well. And that's what happened. And as you can see here, this is the Multiculturalism Act that was in 1988, and you have the English version on the left and the French, the version in French on the right. And if you look at I'm not going to quote the whole or comment on the document itself, that's something you can find online, but if you look at point B, the government of Canada recognizes the existence of communities whose members share a common origin and their historic contribution to Canadian society and enhance their development. That means that actually the government, as it's a public policy and that it's written in law, the government has to assist all of these communities, even financially. Okay, so that's something I don't think we have in France. But in Canada, that is the usual thing. So for example, when an immigrant, some immigrants, not all of them, when they ask to be welcomed in Canada, they are very often oriented towards certain associations, groups that are ethnically defined, and that are paid. They are paid by the Canadian government to take care of these new immigrants, to help them get a job, get housing, get an apartment, and so on. So that's what multiculturalism is. So, well, today, immigration and multiculturalism have become integral parts of the Canadian identity, of the Canadian nation. And even though stereotypes, I was talking about stereotypes before, stereotypes teach us that Canadians are outdoorsy people, they live in cabins, they eat maple syrup. When what you have to tell your students is that 80% of the Canadian population today lives in cities, in big cities. So it's a very urban country. Huh? Nobody lives in the woods anymore. And so 80% of the population lives in cities. That means that the cities are very vibrant. You've got Toronto, you've got Montreal, Quebec City, Vancouver, all the big ones. And it's very diverse. And a lot of immigrants who choose to go to Canada choose the cities first, not to get a job. That's where the work is. Now, what is the result today? There was a census organized in 2021. What can we see today? Well, if you walk in the streets of, in a Canadian city today, 23% of the total population of Canada was born outside the country. So that's practically one in four people born that are immigrants, in fact. And if you take a city like Toronto, it's even more astounding because it's almost half of the population in Toronto that is an immigrant population. So almost half of Torontonians are actually from another country. And if they go, why? It's because, well, Montreal is more of a French-speaking city. And so a lot of immigrants who come from other countries actually choose Toronto over Montreal because of the language that is spoken in that area. And when new immigrants as well arrive, they have to take an oath as well. An oath, it's not called an oath of allegiance, I think that's what you call it in the United States. You take an oath of citizenship in Canada. And it's just a few lines, I would like to read it to you, because they integrated at the same time the rights of the Indigenous peoples of Canada. So if you wish to become an immigrant and take that oath, it goes like this. I swear that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to His Majesty, King Charles III, King of Canada, his heirs and successors, and that I will faithfully observe the laws of Canada, including the Constitution, yes, they have a Constitution, which recognizes and affirms the Aboriginal and treaty rights of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples, and fulfill my duties as a Canadian citizen. So that is the only promise that you have to make when you actually get there. So those are the advantages of multiculturalism, and they even have, even today you have on June 7th of every year, you've got Multiculturalism Day, which is the day when you actually celebrate multiculturalism. You have it on TV, you've got programs about different ethnic communities and things like that. I also wanted to show you these two books that I'm just going to mention. So here we've got What We All Long For. That was written by Dionne Brand. She's a Canadian writer today. And she's from Trinidad. Originally, that's where she was born. And it's a celebration of multiculturalism today. And I included an excerpt in your booklet. And it opens with the description of a subway in the morning in Toronto. And she actually tells us that actually you can see the whole world in one subway in Toronto in the morning when you go to work. You see the entire world there. Good, but it would be, again, it would be, if we look to problematize the question of multiculturalism today, not everybody agrees with this. We get the impression that all Canadians are also another stereotype, very peaceful people, always agreeing with each other. No, it's not the case at all. So a lot of multiculturalism was decided on a federal level, so provinces, especially Quebec, decided to apply to apply multiculturalism, but in their own way. So it would be a mistake, I think, to oversimplify what multiculturalism actually means today in Canada. And that also exposes, this question of multiculturalism exposes a lot of the tensions that you can feel today in Canada. And so if we look at two different categories, I'm going to focus on, again, the Francophones of Quebec and the Indigenous peoples of Canada. Well, if you take the Indigenous peoples of Canada, why should multiculturalism apply to them, since they were the first ones there? Because the idea of multiculturalism is that, okay, there are two official languages, but there is no official culture. That's the whole point. And that's also in the speech given by Trudeau Father in your booklet. So no official culture, but two official languages. But should that apply to the Indigenous peoples of Canada? Since they were there first, shouldn't they have a special place on top of all of this? So that's it's a pretty tricky question. And the Canadian government, of course, did decide or conclude that the Indigenous peoples of Canada have a very central, unique role to play in Canadian society today, given everything that happened to them. And all of those roles given to them were decided during a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was organized in 2008. So the speech given by Stephen Harper, who was the president, who apologized to the Indigenous for the first time, decided to set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in order to grant a lot of substantial payments to Indigenous people, mainly children, who actually had to suffer through the residential schools. So while today's successive governments, again, have recognized that the Indigenous have a very unique place in the Canadian mosaic. I know that the Americans love the word melting pot or salad bowl, while for the Canadians you usually use the image of the mosaic. But at the same time, saying that Indigenous peoples should have a place outside or above multiculturalism, isn't that a way of actually undermining the multicultural ideal at the same time? And multiculturalism can also be construed or understood as some kind of framework imposed by the white settlers to manage minority cultures. So that is also a big problem. And I wanted to talk about this book as well, The Cult of Multiculturalism, Selling Illusions. Oh yes, there was Quebec as well. They chose interculturalism instead of multiculturalism. What does that mean? It means actually that you have interculturalism, and interculturalism accepts all immigrant communities, but with a special focus on the province's linguistic and secular identity. Okay, that's very important too, because it's very close to the French system. For example, when you go to school, you're not supposed to wear, if you're a Muslim girl, you're not supposed to wear a headscarf. In the rest of Canada, that's okay, but not in Quebec. And same thing for all government employees. They are not allowed to have any religious signs on them while working for the government. And so that is what they called interculturalism and reasonable accommodation. So, and that's a very tricky notion as well. Reasonable accommodation, okay, we accept you, but only up to a certain point. And that point being when it conflicts with the culture of the majority. There have been debates about Christmas trees in schools, for example, at Christmas. Should we keep it? Should we get rid of it? And things like that. And they also have the charter, I was talking about that before, the Charter of the French Language that was decided in 1977, where French in Quebec is the official language, the dominant language of Quebec, for business, instruction, schools. And that is also very different from what we have here in France. I don't think that the French feel threatened in linguistic terms. That could be an open question. But a lot of people in Quebec sometimes feel threatened by this Anglophone domination, so they have to protect their language. And for example, it's very common when we go to the movies here in France to see a movie and the title of that movie not translated, you see? But it's against the law in Quebec not to translate all titles of movies. So sometimes you have things like, I don't know, kids in France go see Fast and Furious. In Canada, in Quebec, you go see Rapide et Dangereux. It may seem, but it's the case for all, because it's against the law not to translate. So because of the threatening presence, the overwhelming presence of English in Canada today. And finally, Neil Bassundeth, which is the book I'm showing you here, Selling Illusions, The Cult of Multiculturalism. He was born as well in Trinidad and wrote a book in 1994 called Selling Illusions, right there. And he deplored how multiculturalism ended up confining immigrants within the boundaries of their ethnic communities. That is the main criticism I think we have in France. Mainly not staying inside your community, but exchanging with the rest of the world. And that's what Neil Bassundeth here was talking about, is that when you are from a specific country, you simply transplant that country into Canada and stay there without exchanging with the rest. And he believed that that led to a lack of national cohesion inside the country. So that is still debated as well. Good. And well, despite the appealing nature of the ideal of multiculturalism, even today, the country is not exempt from the rise of racism and populism today. There have been many impacts, even of the election of Donald Trump in the United States, because, well, there's a lot of exchange between Canada and the United States. I believe 80% of all exchanges, trade exchanges, take place between the two countries. And so whenever there's a political event in the U.S., there's bound to be some kind of impact in Canada as well. And so that populism has also led to the rise of populism today in Canada. And one example is 2018, so fairly recently, Maxime Bernier. He was a conservative. He's got the main conservative party, which is the droite in Canada, the right. And he decided to divorce from the conservative party to found his People's Party of Canada. And that is a very far right movement, something that is a lot of Canadians were not familiar with that type of political ideology at the time, and now it's fairly ingrained in Canadian politics today. And his name is Maxime Bernier, so the People's Party of Canada, and he is aggressively against multiculturalism and even immigration. But multiculturalism is still, as I said, an integral part of Canadian society. But because of this rise in racism, they had to add a new anti-racism program in 2019 to complete the public policy of multiculturalism. So, and I'll conclude with a little picture, a class photo, if you prefer, right here. It's not a class photo. I'm not in it. Multiculturalism is still a very sensitive issue. It's a complex question to investigate today, but it has become one of the most defining traits of the Canadian nation. And here is simply Justin Trudeau's cabinet, all of his ministers. And you can see that it's fairly different and varied and so on. I can show you a few, and not all of them were born in Canada, so you can be a minister without actually being born in the country. Here, for example, right here in the top left, is Pablo Rodriguez, who's the Minister of Transportation. He was born in Argentina. There's Ahmed Hussein. He was born in Somalia. We have, his name is Sajan, Harjit S. Sajan, who's the Minister of Pacific Development, and he was born in India. And I think we have here Mary Ng, who was born in Hong Kong. And I think I wanted to conclude with that, and I find this was very, very telling of how Canada has evolved. Here what we have is the Governor General of Canada. The Governor General used to be the representative of the King or Queen in Canada. Now that's no longer the status, the function has remained, but now it's the Prime Minister who chooses and appoints that person to represent Canada outside. And, of course, he chose an Indigenous woman 2 years ago, right here. Her name is Mary Simon, and she's the new Governor General of Canada. So the representative of the King of England today in Canada. So if I had to conclude now, it would say that multiculturalism, again, is complex, but I would use the plural term. There's no such thing, I think, as one perfect multiculturalism, but rather multiculturalisms in the plural sense of the world, of the word. There, and I think that concludes my talk. I hope I wasn't too fast or too long.